Philadelphia is known as the birthplace of America, the city of brotherly love, home of Rocky, the Eagles. It is less known for its murals, but there are thousands of them. It's hard to walk through the center city without passing a painting. They are there thanks to a concerted effort to beautify the city, build community, and fight crime. NPR's Lauren Silverman went to get a look.
I'm standing in a parking lot in downtown Philadelphia, staring at a giant cement wall covered with small, bright tiles.
It's a million pieces of Venetian glass, is what you're seeing.
That's Jane Golden. She's the director of the City of Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program. In the last 26 years, she's helped convert over 3,000 walls into murals. On a bright Saturday morning, she offered to show me around. Our first stop was this mural called Legacy.
We back up and we see a girl. What's she holding?
She's holding the Flame of Liberty. And then around her neck, there are three medals. There's Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and then that is a medal from West Africa. And it's all about the dignity and of the human spirit, and it's about, you know, resilience.
Since 1984, Golden has collaborated with school kids, cops, prisoners, and the elderly to plan and paint murals. The first murals Golden painted with graffiti writers showed people that art in the city streets could be just as significant as art in galleries and museums, and it could be accessible to everyone.
What I love about the outdoor art in this city is that it's like going through a museum, and you come up with your own personal interpretations. It moves you, it inspires you, and it challenges you.
In 2004, leaders of a neighborhood called Mantua submitted an ambitious request. They wanted to paint murals on two apartment buildings that bordered a field trashed with glass shards and old tires. Today, the paintings are done, and the junk below has been replaced by a park.
We got it cleaned up, so there's new playground equipment. There's a
turning Philadelphia into an outdoor art museum has even attracted developers.
They feel that it's safer to build in Mantua. So I look over here, and I see new housing, and I look down the street and see new housing. And while I know that what we're doing isn't a solution for all that is wrong with the city, I want to say that murals show us the catalytic role that art can play in healing a city.
People repeatedly told Golden the murals wouldn't last, that they would just get covered with graffiti again. But only a few have ever been defaced. The bigger challenge is getting everyone on the same page.
What's controversial to one community may not be to another community. So, yes, we have run into projects that have been difficult, complicated, have stirred up acrimony. One project, we had to bring in a Quaker mediator.
Communities sometimes work years on a mural without any guarantee it won't get covered up or torn down. Golden has seen a handful of her murals disappear over the years, but she understands murals are in a constant state of flux, just like the city.
This piece, the lights are installed at the top of the building, and the portions of the painting that are painted in color are going to have color LED lights on them. So
that's Meg Saligman. She's the lead artist of a new mural called The Evolving Face of Nursing.
And when you shine colored light on colored paint, it can appear, disappear, change colors. So this will be, in the evening, an animated mural.
The 6,000-square-foot painting features faces of Philadelphia nurses.
Is that just someone that's looking at it?
Yeah, he's either looking at it or going to pee on it. I'm not sure which.
Actually, he was just one of hundreds of people that visit the murals each week. Golden's recently created an audio tour for the visitors. This October, the Mural Arts Program will unveil dozens of new murals. In the meantime, Golden is busy hunting for more walls.
Oh, that wall's on our waiting list. I love that wall. Isn't that a great wall?
Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
A nice surface, no discernible leaks in the roof.
This is All Things Considered.
Nearly two decades after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia still has tough visa requirements, and not much is easy for visitors. Our correspondent David Green says it's worth the journey, but Russia takes some time to absorb. And he sent us this postcard from St. Petersburg.
You may remember when bands like the Scorpions built up fascination with our Cold War enemy. The Scorpions explored Moscow in 1989 and sang about the Moscow River, the Moskva, and about Russia's famous amusement park.
Follow the Moskva down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change.
A lot hasn't changed. Those sites and, of course, picturesque Red Square are all still here. And it's still daunting to visit. A Russian visa application will make you want to tear your hair out. And in Moscow, like most of Russia, you'll hear very little English. Things are somewhat different up north, in the more European city of St. Petersburg. There are English-speaking boat tours of the city's Amsterdam-like canals.
Right in front of you, there is one of the most widely known bridges of the city, the Anishkov Bridge.
I didn't think it was going to be very good.
32-year-old Sean Dables, a lawyer from San Francisco, he's loving St. Petersburg, just not the torture of getting here. To get visas, he and his friends had to obtain formal invitation letters.
And then you get here and you have to register and tell them you're here. It's like, of course you're here. Didn't they notice at the airport?
Getting around St. Petersburg, he said, much easier than his experience in Moscow.
They weren't making any, you know, semblance of trying to make it easy for tourists. Like, you could either show up and try to figure your way out or not. But it wasn't being spoon-fed as much as St. Petersburg in some ways.
And Russia's doing some spoon-feeding. They've loosened the visa rules in a few places, the major one, St. Petersburg. If you come by cruise ship or ferry, then you can stay 72 hours as long as you never leave the side of your official tour guide.
I'm happy with what we've done here, yes.
Ted Grieve is from Brisbane, Australia.
So you can't leave the group, so to speak.
We cannot leave the group.
And has that been limiting at all? Or?
It has been limiting in that sense.
He's loved what he's seen, the renowned Hermitage Museum, Catherine the Great's Palace, but for a friendly Australian, the welcome's been a bit of a shock.
It just sort of wish that the officials would smile, and they don't. When you come through immigration, very stony-faced, the people sitting in the Hermitage who are giving you the directions and that sort of stuff, very stony-faced.
And sadly, that's a common complaint from so many tourists who are here briefly. This is a culture where it takes some time to feel the warmth. Here's just one example from the Hermitage Museum. Those cruise ship passengers with just an hour to see the Rembrandt and Matisse paintings miss the charm behind the official mask.
Katya! Katya! Смотри, что у меня. Катенька! Катя!
The tour schedule does not include the cats. Yes, one of the world's premier museums has cats wandering the courtyards. Maria Haltunen works in the museum director's office, and she is the self-proclaimed cat press secretary. The animals have been allowed in the palace that houses this museum since the 18th century. Russians have always loved their cats.
It was daughter of Peter the Great who ordered to bring them.
And they have an added benefit. They intimidate rodents. The cats are still free to roam everywhere but the galleries.
That's why we have. Maybe in Louvre there wasn't official tradition to have this kind of animals, but we have.
It can be a pain to get to Russia, and it can feel unwelcoming at first. But there are little charms and a certain poetry to be discovered. Might just take more than 72 hours.
Yeah.
David Green, NPR News, St. Petersburg.
This is NPR.
We're going to hear now from a dramatist who's turned her attention to the basics, the ABCs. Chiara Alegria Hudes has written about the lingering wounds of war in her play Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue. She also wrote the book for the hit Broadway musical In the Heights. That's the tale of one block in New York, peopled with immigrants from Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, and set to the rhythms and rhymes of Latin music and hip-hop. Now, Chiara Hudes is out with her first tale for kids. It's called Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC, located in the city of her childhood.
I decided to set this book in North Philadelphia, where many of my family live, including my grandma and many young cousins. And the concept was that one girl who's from North Philadelphia, where a lot of Latinos live, is giving a tour, a neighborhood tour, to her best friend who's from Chinatown, and he's come to visit her for the day.
And it's from the point of view of that little girl who is, as you say, introducing her friend to her neighborhood. Let's just start with A.
Okay. So let's see. Here we start with A is for abuela and abandoned car.
And abuela is a grandmother.
That's right. You know, I think one of the defining features for me growing up in my neighborhood was an older generation from Puerto Rico who had an open door policy in what many considered from the outside to be a dangerous neighborhood. But in fact, this open door policy is what kept people safe. It was how children were supervised playing outside. And it's how, you know, a hungry neighbor could be fed after work if they didn't have time to go home and cook, if they didn't have money to go and get something from, you know, the corner restaurant.
Now, right off in the A's, there's an abandoned car. It's not too tough, but real clearly this is not an affluent neighborhood.
That's right. My inspiration for writing this book wasn't to talk about how gritty and real the neighborhood was. It was more about the joy of observing, so that we're not just watching TV all the time, we're not just looking at our little tiny screens all the time, but look and see what's around you, observe what's around you. So in this case, that includes, you know, an abuela hugging the grandkids, and it does include an abandoned car, you know, and that has some downsides to it, no doubt, but there's interest and stories in all of those things.
Well, even though when you are illustrating with your words parts of the neighborhood that might not be considered beautiful, the language itself is spare and really quite lovely. Read us the B's.
B is for the bottles that are smashed like falling stars. Broken bottles of black cherry soda bought at Barrio Bodegas. C is for the Chino Latino corner store we call Ortega's.
That's a lovely way of seeing it. It could very well be a child's way of seeing smash bottles on the street glinting. And the illustration, they're multicolored.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember I collect marbles. I have collected marbles since I was a kid, and I still collect them, and now my daughter loves them. And I've always just found, you know, different colored glass to be kind of fanciful and playful. And so I remember one of the features of a lot of the sidewalks in Philadelphia is that the broken glass has actually become imprinted into the cement. So the sidewalk can actually take on a mosaic quality. It's a totally chaotic mosaic. But, you know, these are the things I would notice when I was just kind of walking from Abuela's house to the corner store to get her milk or something like that. And I realized today, you know, this is a little nostalgic because everyone has plastic bottles today. So the broken glass might not be as common now as it was when I was a kid.
Why don't you read some more for us? Pick up anywhere you'd like.
I'll start with the ice cream truck because that is where any youthful story should actually start. But A is not for ice cream, so I'll pick up at the letter I. I is for the ice cream truck in infinite flavors so sweet. J is for los jíbaros, jamming in the jungle of concrete. K is for the kitchen window where kidney beans boil and pork chops pop. L is for the living room ledges and little old ladies who guard the block. M is for los muralistas, making murals of island vistas, waterfalls that hide brick walls, rainforests full of tropical trees. N is for the noisy neighbors who sit on the stoop and catch the breeze.
How did you settle on the words to represent the letters of the alphabet? Because some are English and some are Spanish, like Q, for instance.
Well, Q is for quemar, which is to burn a house to the ground beneath, making a block full of row homes look like a smile that's missing its two front teeth. Q is like X. It's one of those letters that's, you know, notoriously difficult in alphabet books, and, you know, it ends up being queen. You know, there's a handful of three things that it'll end up being, but in Spanish, it's a much more frequently used letter, and it's one of the darker passages in the book, but you know, the thing about growing up in North Philly and, you know, a house would burn down or a house would kind of fall apart and be dilapidated. And then I had an aunt who led a movement to turn abandoned lots into public gardens. And we get to that part later in the book. So even points that might be a little bit darker in the book end up having a flip side, like a growth, a life to them.
There are a couple of poignant passages here. R is very touching, especially from a child's eye view.
R is about growing up in a language and in a geography that's very different from the one where your parents grew up. You know, I grew up in cement and brick, and, you know, my parents grew up in the countryside in Puerto Rico, speaking Spanish, and that's all captured in R, and I'll read R right now. R for mommy's favorite word. She always says, remember. Remember that, remember when, remember all the things now gone. Remember red comb rooster singing kikiriki to the dawn. Remember Rincon Beach in Puerto Rico, how the sun would set.
And you would hear that from your own mother or your aunties or something like that?
They always said remember. And in fact, before I made the decision to become a writer, my grandmother was getting along in years and her health was suffering. And my mom said to me, you know, you're the one who's gone to college. You're the one who can write these stories down. So ask her the stories and write them down or they'll be gone.
Playwright Chiara Alegria Hudis has written the children's book Welcome to My Neighborhood, a Barrio ABC. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can see illustrations from the Barrio ABCs, including the ice cream truck of I, at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition for NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
The BP oil spill has generated nearly 47,000 tons of oily solid waste so far, everything from tar balls to used boom to oiled vegetation. That waste has been sent to landfills along the Gulf Coast, and that has led to environmental and health worries among local communities. Daryl Malik Wiley is a field organizer with the Sierra Club working on environmental justice issues. He joins us from New Orleans. And Daryl, why don't you explain first how this oily waste is processed?
Well, the oily waste is picked up by ships or by gentlemen picking up tar balls, put into containers, taken to a sorting location, and then shipped to different landfills along the Gulf Coast.
Okay. And would it be considered hazardous waste? Would that determine what kind of landfill it can be sent to?
That's one of the arguments that we're having with the Environmental Protection Agency. They're not considering it as a hazardous waste, so it can go to any landfill that has a liner in it, any municipal landfill.
And what would determine whether something is considered hazardous waste?
It's complicated, but what they're saying is their testing is not finding any hazardous characteristics. Also, there is a loophole in the federal law dealing with oil exploration and production waste that by law makes it non-hazardous.
Because I would assume that this is such a busy community under the best of times that a lot of oily waste would be generated all the time and it would be sent somewhere.
Right. It's sent to landfills that aren't as strictly regulated as a hazardous waste landfill because of this exemption for the waste. And there have been a number of incidents throughout history in Louisiana with real problems at oil field waste disposal sites.
And what kind of problems are you most worried about?
Air emissions going into communities, other places they've injected it under the ground. In some cases, that has come back up in other locations. So those are a couple of the environmental issues related to the oil field waste.
What sorts of things would they be testing for when they test the oily waste?
They're testing for a series of different chemicals that are usually found in oil, and they're also looking at some oils have heavy metals just because where they're coming out of the reservoir. So they're looking at a suite also of heavy metal testing.
Mm-hmm. I did read this from one scientist that the oil that's being brought in is so degraded from being out in the Gulf for so long that a lot of the most worrisome chemicals would have evaporated. Do you think that's true?
Some of the benzenes and toluenes that are definitely known to cause cancer have been evaporating, but there hasn't been enough air testing to confirm that there haven't been then clouds of benzenes, toluenes impacting coastal communities.
I'm wondering, Mr. Malik Wiley, the waste has to go somewhere, right? And there's a lot of it. What would you have them do with it that they're not doing right now?
Well, we would like to see it, you know, in a special segment of landfills, if it's going to a municipal landfill, some way that we can segregate it and possibly come back and look at it in future time. The other possibility is sending it to a hazardous waste landfill, which has higher standards as far as protecting the environment from anything getting out into the air, water, or land.
Have you heard any specific complaints from people in the communities, any health concerns that they have right now, things they've started to see?
I have not. That's one thing that I've been talking with a number of community leaders around the state in Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama, trying to identify people who live right next to the sites. And we're working to hold a meeting of the directly impacted community sometime in September.
So nothing so far?
Nothing so far, correct.
I've been talking with Daryl Malik Wiley. He's a field organizer with the Sierra Club in New Orleans. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. It seems likely home sales declined again in July. That's what many analysts were predicting. We'll get the real numbers when the National Association of Realtors releases its monthly statistics later this morning. Economists say it's unlikely the housing market will experience a significant recovery until the country's job market improves. NPR's Jeff Brady has our story from Denver.
Denver didn't have the run-up in prices over the past decade that cities like Las Vegas, Miami, and Phoenix did, so prices haven't fallen through the floor. Still, there's pain here. Ask Bob Lynn, who co-owns Peak Property Development Company.
We're a fix-and-flip company. We buy houses, fix them up, and sell them.
Inside one of those houses just east of downtown Denver, Lynn points out all the extras he installed to make this house appealing to buyers. He raised the ceiling, put new granite counters in the kitchen, and installed wood floors. The sales price is pretty close to the median for this neighborhood.
$295,000.
And is that what you expected?
No, I expected $325,000.
And it took a little longer than you expected to sell it?
Yes, it took way too long.
9 months, says Lynn. He's accustomed to his projects selling before he's even done. But he says lenders are extra picky on loan applications these days. And even with interest rates well under 5%, Lynn says buyers are still hesitant, not sure if the bottom of the market has arrived. But there are some people benefiting from the current market, and Lynn doesn't have to look far to find them. His business partner, Fred Schneider, is out sprucing up the front yard. He bought his condo just 6 months back.
It's a third story. It's got a fireplace and washer dryer. It's about 1,050 square feet, which is a pretty good size. Great mountain views.
Schneider says he took advantage of the federal tax credit for first-time home buyers that expired at the end of April. And he says the place was a steal. He says it changed hands just a few years before he bought it.
It sold for $96,000, and we picked it up for $44,000.
Wow. That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Predicting when the housing market is going to turn around is occupying a lot of smart minds these days. Just before the tax credit expired, existing home sales went up. But then after the credit, they went down again.
Well, it's kind of in limbo. That would be the best way to describe it.
William Wheaton is an economics professor at MIT who specializes in the real estate market.
I think when the economy recovers or starts to recover, we'll see a pickup in sales. And as long as the level of building activity stays low, the inventory should continue to decline, and that'll set the stage for a recovery in prices.
Meanwhile, investors will be watching the numbers. Tomorrow, the Commerce Department releases statistics on new home sales for July. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're going to be taking you on a tour of New Orleans today and in the coming days, to see how that city is doing 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. For many children of that city, their world was turned upside down by the storm. Many were shunted from one house and one school to another. Those who returned to the city found a school system that was in complete upheaval and is still undergoing major changes today. NPR's Larry Abramson talked with two sons of New Orleans about their experiences.
Donnell Bailey lives in a cozy little row house on St. Ann Street in New Orleans' mid-city neighborhood. It is a world of doting women, from his grandmother to his aunt to his mother, Tracy, who is quick to show visitors the family photos that cover the coffee table.
Yeah, that's our family. That's my mom and my brother. He's in the Marines.
The air conditioner battles the afternoon heat as Donnell sits down and tells me what happened in August 2005. He was 10 years old then, on a fast track to failure, like many kids, in the city's corrupt, low-scoring school system. He was held back after failing a fourth-grade achievement test. Donnell admits he wasn't trying, but neither was the neighborhood school.
I don't think I ever heard of the word college at that school. I'm being honest.
All that changed after the storm. Donnell left the city before Katrina arrived with his Marine uncle and grandmother and spent the rest of that school year in Houston. Just by chance, Donnell ended up at a school set up in Houston by a national charter organization known as KIPP.
When I first went to KIPP in the fifth grade in Houston, the first thing that I learned was that I'm going to college in 2013.
At first, Donnell struggled with the school's stern discipline, with the emphasis on achievement. But something happened. He bonded with his teachers, and he started to get some traction.
Hello, Miss Cummins. How's it going?
Give me a real handshake, please. Thank you. How are you?
A year after Katrina, Donnell's family returned to New Orleans, and he ended up here, at McDonough 15, a Kip-run school in the city's French Quarter. Nicole Cummins remembers what Donnell was like when she first taught him.
He is really funny, but he didn't quite have a harness on what was appropriate for the classroom.
Donnell realized that his impish sense of humor and his love of wordplay could get him attention without getting him in trouble. The misfit became a star. Donnell was elected class president the same year that Barack Obama was elected to the White House.
I just have to say he did take my spot as the country's first African-American president, just saying.
And you can be the first president from New Orleans.
Yes, and the nation's fully black president. Obama is half and half. I'm the total package.
Donnell might have succeeded even without Katrina, but it's hard to imagine that. The storm led to the takeover of nearly all the city's schools. It sparked a rush of charter school operators like Kip. They brought waves of idealistic young educators like Nicole Cummins, who opened new doors to kids like Donnell. But for many other families, Katrina and the new education landscape added new frustrations to old ones.
Did you see the ink on the players?
On the brand new pants.
Yeah, where you full of ink.
On the other side of town, Ronald McCoy and his wife, Anil, are trying to get ink out of their grandson's school uniform.
He loves to work me. Yeah.
Their grandson, John Baumbach, is sitting at the dining room table. He's lived with his grandparents since he was a baby. The family says he has attention deficit disorder, and John admits he has a hard time paying attention in school.
It's just that sometimes I need extra help with it. Like, if I don't get it the first time, sometimes it gets hard for me to get it. And sometimes I get off track a lot because I start tapping. Because I can't stay in one spot for a long time because I start fidgeting.
Mm-hmm. Like you're doing now?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
John fiddles constantly with anything he can get his hands on. He's a pretty child, slight with fine features, his hair in neat cornrows. On the wall of the family home, there's a huge portrait of Gianni, John's uncle and Ronald's son. Gianni was a football star, the pride and joy of the family. He was shot to death in 2007, a victim of the city's high murder rate.
And it wasn't intended for him. You know, they were shooting at someone else, and a bullet struck him. But that's his daughter up on top, the top picture of the little girl graduating. That's the little girl he left behind.
The loss of the uncle he idolized is just one of the challenges facing John Baumbach. Before the storm, he had behavior problems at the neighborhood school he attended. John evacuated to Morgan City, Louisiana, just before the storm, and says he liked his school there. But when the family returned to New Orleans a year later, Ronald McCoy says John's old neighborhood school was suddenly full of security guards and metal detectors.
And you go in other neighborhoods besides urban neighborhoods, and you don't go through this. You do not go through this at all.
This is a common complaint here, that the post-Katrina school system has relied too heavily on security guards and harsh discipline in the relentless quest to boost test scores. The new school system is supposed to give parents choice, a menu of charters, magnet schools, and traditional public schools. But Ronald McCoy says everywhere they turn, his grandson's issues are neglected. A Kip charter school, like the one Donnell Bailey attended, recruited them, but they say John never got the individual attention they were promised.
It was lip service. It was really lip service, you know, because they were really trying to get kids into their school. I don't have no problem with being strict, but when it gets to the point where it's like a concentration camp, I do have a problem.
Other parents have the same complaint, that New Orleans schools have ignored special education issues like John's. That led to a recent legal complaint by a civil rights group here. Samuel J. Green Charter is John's third school since Katrina. As he begins eighth grade here, his future is uncertain.
I'm trying to make the tape on the ground, how we have to walk, could we have to stay on the right side of the wall.
After class, John shows his grandfather a recent addition. The halls have narrow lines of tape along each side of the hallway. Kids must stay on the tape, even if that doubles the distance to the next classroom.
Just walking this line, like I said, I have been incarcerated. And that's where I learned about walking behind those lines and staying on the right-hand side of the wall.
It's the first day of school for Donnell Bailey. He's in his second year at a private school in the suburbs of New Orleans. His KIPP school recommended him, and Metairie Park Country Day School is helping to cover his tuition costs here. He's brand new to this mostly white private school, but still he was elected class president at the end of last year.
Last year you were brand new in this.
Yes, yes, but you know, it's welcoming. A lot of people are calling me president now, so it's cool.
For Donnell Bailey, the post-Katrina reality is very cool, a brand new chapter in a young life. For many others, it's the same old story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.